Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about. In 2015, Charleston, South Carolina was rocked by two shootings. On April 4th, Walter Scott was shot in the back by a North Charleston police officer. Then in July, in a shocking act of hate, nine people in prayer were killed in Mother Emanuel Church. Marvin Pendaris, a young Black attorney, felt called by these tragic events to serve his community. He ran for the city council and barely lost. Then he ran for the state legislature and won. We talk about that path to service, South Carolina politics, and strategies for economic empowerment based on his mother's experience raising five kids as a single mom. He has a powerful story and a message about the urgency of making an impact. Enjoy. South Carolina Representative Marvin Pendaris, welcome to An Honorable Profession. Look forward to talking to you today.
It's an honor to be here, and thank you for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So let's just start with a view from the ground of South Carolina. What is going on? You're an important state politically in the primaries now. What are you seeing in both politics and in the new legislative session?
You know, this is my seventh year in the General Assembly. We do our sessions on a two-year cycle. So this is the second year of a two-year session. Just coming off of a robust budget debate where we approved a $13.5 billion budget. What I will tell you what South Carolina is doing, there are a number of issues that I think have permeated our state house that come from a lot of national groups. One of the things that we've talked about quite a bit this year and will be debated, we just passed a permitless carry gun bill, which was obviously a debate that got a lot of attention, especially in light of things that have happened nationally with school shootings and just mass shootings in general. And so that sparked a lot of debate here in the South Carolina General Assembly. We're also dealing with the big debate that we're getting ready to have over the next couple of weeks with diversity, equity, and inclusion in college campuses and how that looks. There's a bill that's made its way to the House floor where we'll be debating that in a couple of weeks. And so it's been a busy session. I will tell people it's probably one of the busier sessions that I've had just because each week we're not only just taking up substantive bills, but we're doing a lot of committee work as well. And the bills that have made it to the House floor for debate have been ones where they've obviously sparked a lot of attention nationally and even with just the news media looking into the issues that we're talking about, but even more so amongst the members. Obviously, there's going to be a partisan divide with a number of these issues. A lot of these issues are social issues, and we can't ignore the fact that it is an election year, and that's a driving point as well, not only for the General Assembly, but also a presidential election year where a lot of these issues are being talked about on a national level and have trickled down into our state house. So it's been a busy session, a productive one for sure, but one that we're continuing to plow through.
You're working from the minority. How do you make sure that your voice and more importantly, your constituents' voice are heard in the process through some of these bills?
Well, I've always prided myself on making sure that I was available to the people and responsive to their needs. And there isn't a vote that I take or bill that I read where I'm not thinking about the 40,000 people that I represent back home in the city of North Charleston. And so I think about that often, and I let their viewpoints drive me into my decision making, and especially letting them know that not only do they have an informed representative, but they have a representative that's responsive to their needs and makes it a point to bring them into this discussion because, you know, I'm just a representative of the people. You know, I'm their voice here in Columbia. And when we're talking about these issues that can sometimes drive a wedge between members and colleagues that I serve with, and certainly can serve as the topic of much debate and scrutiny, it's important that the voice of the people is not lost in this process. And I've prided myself on making sure that I represent them in that way, that they understand that their voices are heard in the decision-making process, which is why I continue to engage them through newsletters. Obviously, social media is a big part of how I engage my constituents. I take numerous emails from them. You know, I'll host groups here in Columbia at the State House. It's the people's house, and I want people to know that they can come here anytime and set up meetings and ask questions of their representative, because it's important that I represent them in the best way and that they understand that the issues and the concerns that they have are legitimate and they're being taken into consideration throughout the debate process. And I try to do that. And it's what I've done the 7 years that I've been up here and will continue to do.
And you have to raise objections to problematic legislation, but you also have to move your agenda forward. What are your goals for this legislative session?
Well, what I'll say is my agenda changes each year. For this year, I've been very narrowly focused on particular issues. For me, the biggest issue this year is economic empowerment. How do we give people the tools necessary in order to be productive from an economic standpoint? So how do we change the conditions that exist within certain underserved communities? How does that look through education, making sure that we're giving people opportunities to get a quality education that's going to allow them to lead a quality life and really help communities thrive? We know when we have thriving schools, we have thriving communities, making sure that there are job opportunities that exist in real unique ways, you know, connecting people to the many industry that's coming to South Carolina. And so many of the bills that I filed and much of the legislation that I support is geared toward that. So my agenda is one that's economic based. You know, I'm about how do we put people in positions to succeed, not only put money in their pocket, but giving them the tools necessary for them to be able to be successful. So I filed several pieces of legislation that'll allow us to do that, whether that be tax incentives, whether that be development opportunities that exist within local municipalities, or whether that be bills dealing with rental units and how we deal with evictions and education bills that I've supported that'll allow us to be able to make sure that we're supporting our teachers, we're supporting the students in our classrooms and giving them the support that they need, because it's all about building thriving communities for me. That is something that I've said, that I said when I first got elected, and it's something that I continue to preach, because I truly believe when we take care of the whole person, when we take care of the whole community, we build a community that can thrive on its own. And I think government plays a role in making sure that these communities have the resources so that the people that live there can be successful. And when we take care of the people that live there, then those communities will thrive and we can have a society that we can be proud of. And that's generally what I've preached, and certainly what the legislation that I filed and continue to support it touches on.
What's the support like from a bipartisan point of view for that legislation? How do you bring folks together to drive that agenda?
What I tell my colleagues, thriving communities doesn't have an R or a D. You know, thriving communities aren't red or blue. And the people that exist in these communities need us to support them as their representatives, making sure that we're doing everything that we can in our capacity as elected officials to take care of them and to make sure that they're thriving in a way that's going to be meaningful and going to bring about the kind of changes. I talk to my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, and I try to make the economic case. I try to make the human case, in understanding that these constituents that I serve, they all don't look like me. They all don't vote like me. And we pride ourselves on the diversity that exists within our community, and that we need to be able to support legislation that's going to promote people, that's going to promote growth, that's going to support the institutions that exist within our communities. And we've been successful. Our team has been successful in selling that message to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. Certainly, it's not an easy task, being in the super minority here in South Carolina, but we do the best that we can. it's, you know, being in the super minority, I think it's more incumbent upon us and raises the stakes as far as forcing us to be able to work across the aisle, building relationships with people on various committees and building relationships with the members of the General Assembly so that we can get things done, deliver for our district, and making sure that we're taking care of the people of South Carolina.
I'm curious your thoughts, because I think the Democratic Party nationwide has made some real investments in economic opportunity through the Infrastructure Act and beyond, Inflation Reduction Act, but it doesn't seem to resonate with people in terms of support or trust in the Democrats to deliver on the economy. What do you think nationally Democrats need to do better to get that economic message across and have people really believe in this approach to economic empowerment?
Well, I'm a proud Democrat, and I'm not afraid to say this, and I've told my colleagues this. We have a messaging problem in the Democratic Party, and that has been the issue, because Democrats, if you look at it nationally, things are getting done under this administration, but the problem is the people back home, the people that are being impacted by this, are not seeing how the successes of this administration are affecting them. And so I'll give you an example. I was getting a haircut roughly a month ago, and my barber and I, we've got a good relationship, and we talk shop a lot, right? And so I'm in the chair, and it's like your typical barbershop talk. We talk sports, we talk politics, we talk, you know, culture, music, whatever's on our mind, we're talking about. But this particular evening, we were having a conversation about this election. And he said, "Pendarvis, man, you know, what do you think about this administration?" I said, "I think they're doing a good job, but we're just not selling the wins. We're not sending a message to people that they can latch on to and understand that there are things being done by the party." He said, "I agree with you." And he told me a story about how in 2020, he sat out the 2020 election. And I said, "Why?" He said, "I sat out because I did not believe in the message that was being delivered or talked about by Joe Biden. And I did not believe in what Donald Trump was talking about either. And I just said, you know what? I don't believe in either of these messages. I think, you know, I feel disconnected from both parties and from both candidates for the presidency. And I'm going to sit this one out." And he said, "But in doing that," he said, "you know, and 4 years later, I believe," he said, "I am excited to vote in the 2024 election. And I'm excited to vote for Democrats up and down the ballot." And I said, "Well, why, you know, the change? What happened in these last 4 years for you to feel so excited and to feel like you see something being done?" He said, "Because he was naming the infrastructure, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the CHIPS and Science Act, talked about the Inflation Reduction Act, and how the jobs that were coming as a result of those, how the infrastructure, being able to see what's happening with our roads and bridges here in South Carolina." He said, "I can see the tangible results of things that are being done by Democrats. And I feel like I see the impact that it's having on my life. And I know that I cannot sit this out. I have to be engaged, and I have to make sure that I'm making my voice known and telling people that." And so it dawned on me in that moment when he told me that, you know, we've got to be able to tell more stories like my barber. We've got to be able to show how the results of the successes of this administration are impacting people on a day-to-day basis. That's what it's about. On a day-to-day basis, how can we extrapolate what is being done on the national level, package it in a way that resonates with the everyday working person, and so that they can see how it's benefiting their lives? And when we do that, I firmly believe we will be able to galvanize people. We'll be able to mobilize them in a way that we haven't before. People will start to feel that they have a stake in this. That's why I speak about messaging, because people, when they don't feel like they've got a stake in what's happening and that they feel disconnected and it's not impacting them, then they're going to be disengaged. They're going to feel like there's nothing that can be done that's going to impact them, because they feel like they're being left out. But when we change that and we message it in a way that people understand, then we'll be able to bring more to the table and bring more on board. And I tell that story because it's a real life example of how things are being done on the national level, and how it's trickled down into the states and into our local governments and into, you know, into the barbershop where I spoke with my barber and we were able to have that conversation.
We got to send a lot more people to that barbershop. Millions, millions. He's got some hair to cut in the next 10 months through this election. Can we talk a little bit about the politics in South Carolina? You all played a key role in the both the Democrat and Republican primary. Nikki Haley, your former governor, ended up losing in the primary. Like, what do we need to know as outsiders about how politics is playing out on the ground in these primary battles?
Well, you know, South Carolina being first on the calendar, I think there's a lot of renewed focus on what's happening here, being an early battleground, well, early state. And especially, you know, for even though Joe Biden was going to be the nominee, there was a lot of foundational work being done from a party standpoint, knowing that we play a significant role. We know what happened in 2020 with Congressman Clyburn's endorsement and how it was able to lead to Joe Biden being able to be the ultimate Democratic nominee and president. And so I'll tell you, on the ground here in South Carolina is unique. You know, I get questions a lot about when Tim Scott ran, our United States Senator, and Nikki Haley, former Governor Haley, in her run for president and her staying in to the very last minute and not even making the decision that she wasn't going to endorse because she felt like there were more voters that Donald Trump needed to cater to and talk to. It shows the diversity that we have here and that South Carolina plays a pivotal role in national politics. That's just how we've been and what we'll continue to be on both sides of the aisle. You see that, you know, the elected leaders in South Carolina continue to contribute nationally. And so the landscape here is a unique one because it tells you, you know, on one hand, you've got two native South Carolinians that ran for president of the United States, but weren't able to get the traction that you thought they would and didn't even really, you know, even though they're beloved here in the state, they weren't able to get the kind of traction to where South Carolinian says, we want you to be our president. I think a lot of that is because of the Trump phenomena and the fact that, you know, he is so popular in this state and that there are so many people in South Carolina that have, you know, really support him and feel impacted by him to where they show up in numbers and they were able to outperform both Scott and Haley. That's what I'll say. You know, there's a heavy Trump presence here. We know what he did, how he carried South Carolina in 2020, obviously carrying it here in the presidential primary last month. He is widely popular. His popularity has not waned. In fact, he's probably only increased in popularity here in South Carolina. And so it's unique in that way where we can have two people who contributed a lot, a sitting U.S. senator and a former governor, not get traction here running for president. But again, it's the Trump factor. We've seen it play out across the national level.
Were you surprised? Because, I mean, in theory, they have relationships with everybody in every corner of the state that they could call on to run real campaigns there. And yet it didn't seem to materialize or, as you say, got overwhelmed by the support for Trump. Was it surprising to you at all? Or do you think that was sort of inevitable?
I wasn't surprised by the ultimate outcome. I had always suspected that Donald Trump would win the nomination and that he would win South Carolina. What I was surprised by was how I thought Nikki Haley would have done better. And so that did catch me by surprise because she was pretty popular, obviously being an ambassador as well. She's been pretty popular in South Carolina. And so I thought that she would have been able to get more traction than she ultimately did not. And so that caught me by surprise.
Let's shift gears here and talk about you. How did you find yourself in the State House watching all this national and state politics up close and participating in it? What's your path to public office?
I'm just a kid from Charleston Farms, you know, small community in North Charleston. And, you know, my story is a story of grit and determination and overcoming odds and being in a position where I could help people and ultimately deciding that I wanted to take the plunge to get into public office. But it wasn't by happenstance. There was a lot of work that went into it. You know, I'm the son of a single mom, the only boy of five children. and my mom worked to make sure that she could take care of my sisters and I. But oftentimes that wasn't enough. And it was seeing her grind and seeing her suffer setback after setback and the many ups and downs that existed because of our economic condition back home. It really drove me to want to set myself up for future success and to be in a position where I could help my family and to be someone that rose above the circumstances that existed within the community that I grew up in. And so I decided that I wanted to go to college and was able to go to the University of South Carolina. I said I wanted to be a lawyer and ultimately went on to law school and graduated from law school and started practicing law. But my mom would be the person that I said gave me the spirit of public service. I watched her as a kid work the polls. I watched her talk about current events at the kitchen table where we would discuss what was happening just in life and what was happening around us. She made it a point to make sure we were informed and making sure that we knew that there were institutions in place that govern our daily lives and that make the way we do things possible in a lot of ways. And so it was important for us to understand those institutions. We're, you know, introduced to those institutions because of our economic condition and the poverty that we lived in. And how those institutions, oftentimes not fair as a kid, led to us not necessarily being able to climb out on our own, which is why I believe government plays a role in making sure that we're able to set people up for success. So I would say she gave me that spirit, you know, combination of her and just our conditions growing up was what drove me to want to serve in some way. And so I got to college, was in student government in college, and I would say, you know, the turning point would have probably been the 2008 election. Barack Obama, a freshman at the University of South Carolina. Obviously, there's a lot of attention, a first African-American on a ballot, and an opportunity to change history and to make history. And being part of that on the grassroots level and supporting that campaign and canvassing and just, you know, feeling the energy and seeing it, being inspired and say, man, I would love to be in public office one day. I could see myself being in a position to change lives, to make lives better for people that grew up like me and to be in a position to help people like I felt like when Obama was elected as president. And so that carried on into, you know, my graduation from law school and ultimately when I moved back home and started practicing. But there were two moments that set me on running for office earlier than I'd anticipated. For me, you know, running for public office was always like a feather in the cap of after a long legal career. I said, yeah, I'll run for office, but I'm going to make some money. I'm going to do what I need to do in the law profession, you know, start a family and do all of those things. And then once it's time for me to, you know, call it a career, then, you know, I'll jump in and offer myself a public service. But that changed in 2015. There were two things that happened locally. There was an officer-involved shooting in 2015 in April of that year. Gentleman Walter Scott was shot 9 times by a North Charleston police officer. And then there was the Mother Emanuel shooting that summer at Mother Emanuel. And those two events changed the trajectory, I would say, of my political career, or accelerated, I would say, my political career, because I felt obligated to get involved. I was speaking out at forums. I was going to meetings and offering my thoughts on what happened. And I found my voice. I found myself being in a position to where I thought I could help people. And I remember it as plain as day. There was a meeting that we had at someone's home one summer that year. And someone said, there's municipal elections happening and we need people to run for city council. And I decided at that moment that I was going to run for a seat on the North Charleston City Council. And I did. I lost that race. I received 303 votes, came in third out of a 4-way race. But it was probably the greatest loss of my career because it set the stage for everything else to come next. And I stayed involved even though I lost. I got involved in local party politics and local organizations, served on the zoning board for the city. And then in 2017, the seat opened. Once my predecessor resigned from the House in order to become a judge, there was a special election. And You know, I got multiple calls saying, we see your work. We see you've been doing a number of things. You ought to run for the seat. And so I did. And I won. And that was 7 years ago. And it's been a joy and an honor and one of the greatest privileges that's been bestowed upon me to be a representative of the place that I grew up, the place where my mother still lives, the place that taught me so much. It's truly an honor and one that I do not take lightly.
What a journey. I guess as a follow-up, let me just ask if, you know, a young attorney out there, somebody out there who's starting their career and is in the same mindset of like, I got to get established financially, I got to get established professionally, and then I can think about public service. What do you think the benefit is of jumping in right away and serving in whatever capacity you can?
The benefits of jumping in right away is that you can learn. And that one, you know, I've always been a proponent that we need young people to run for office. I've been a big proponent of people, you know, if not now, then when, right? If not you, then who? And that's what one of my good friends and colleagues told me when I first ran. And so I've always been a big proponent of young people doing that. But there's so many benefits. If you look at some of the, you know, I'll give you a historical perspective why this is important, and then I'll kind of come, you know, things will come full circle. But if you look at it historically, and if you look at this country's history and the biggest movements that set the stage for so many of the things that exist today, right? They were led by young people. If you look at the civil rights movement, if you think about what happened with so many of the rights and liberties that we are able to have, so many of those movements were started by young people who saw that they had a voice that did not necessarily wait until they were told to do it, but said, you know what, we have something to offer and we can offer it now. And it's in that same spirit that I serve and why it's important that I encourage young people to run, because there's so much that you can offer. It's a new perspective. It's new ideas. It's an opportunity to learn and to immerse yourself in a system that you've been able to grow and see and observe as a young folks. And I think there needs to be diversity of opinions and ideas and backgrounds in any legislative body, whether that be on the local level or the national level. We need people of all different ages to be able to offer something and to feel like they can contribute. And then I feel like me being in office, it's inspired others. I've been told that, you know, there are people who look at my service and say, man, if he can do it, then I can do it. You know, maybe I ought to look at how I can serve my community. And it may not look like public office. Maybe you're inspired to serve on a board or to be more involved in your organization or to run for the president of an organization as a young person because you see you want to make impact. That's all it's about, making impact and making impact in your current station and being able to make an impact in the way that you're able to bring something about and some meaningful change to the communities that you serve and represent. And so there's so much that young people can bring to the table. I'm always encouraged when young folks get elected to office, and I'm proud to be in that number.
I love it. I couldn't agree more. We love having you in the New Deal, and we look forward to watching you spread this desire for impact, especially economic opportunity for all people. It's exciting to see. We thank you for your work.
Well, thank you. It's an honor and a privilege. I mean, I'm so honored to be part of the New Deal and the relationships that I've been able to make while part of it.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service, and because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.